Hello, everyone. This is Clarissa Bell, and welcome to the teleclass. And today is April the 12th, 2011. Wow, 2011 already. 2012 is right around the corner, and we are already gone through the first quarter of 2011. It just amazes me the way time just seems to just be going so, so fast. Well, today is the topic we're going to be doing is You Are Not a Person, but before we do that, let's just take a few minutes just to center ourselves and just to bring our energy here now. So just if you can, close your eyes as you're driving. Please don't. Just hear my words and just imagine a golden ball of light, a yellow golden ball of light right in the center of your head. And we're just going to imagine that it's a very, very powerful magnet. And just see this golden ball of light right in your forehead, right behind your eyes is where your third eye would be. And it's this powerful magnet. And it has the ability to just attract all of your energy that may be out attaching to thoughts. And you want to just imagine this magnet just gathering them all up and just collecting them right into this center of light, very softly, very gently. It's so powerful, it's done. The minute you thought it, it's done. And just taking a, becoming aware of your breath, and maybe deepening the breath a little, and just allowing your energy to be right with you. Your energy is just here, not out attaching to thoughts, but right here. And let's give thanks for this opportunity, for this moment, and this journey, in this moment, in this time, which we have created the time, but it's just this moment, and time is just to mark these moments. So let's just be thankful for this moment, this time together, this experience together, and this opportunity to explore interesting things together. Dropping your energy awareness down into your heart center and imagine your energy just gathering into that heart and imagine a ball of light, this ball of light. So let's imagine it's a pink light and your energy is just gathering here. Feel your heart self, your heart energy. See this ball swirling and rotating around, and the energy is just moving around you almost like a vortex or a top that's spinning. And just feel your love. That's you. That's your love and how beautiful it is. And it is there 24/7. We're just becoming aware of it. And if it feels good to you, just imagine that this love also just going out and just imagining sending thoughts of love and joy and thanksgiving and ease and gloriousness and beauty to anyone who is in the space to receive it, who would like to just be tapped. They could pick up on that thought and tap, just like a little Cupid. All this is just for fun. There's no seriousness. It's just all fun, things that we could do to play around with energy. And now just bringing your attention back to where you're sitting, to your body, in contact with wherever whatever's touching your body or supporting your body. Bringing our awareness here to the room, to your feet, down to the earth, grounded here. And opening your eyes if you've closed them. And today's topic is You Are Not a Person. Well, what do I mean by you are not a person? Some of you may have read that and thought, what? What the heck is that? I know, it's pretty funny. Okay, so what I mean by you're not a person, or maybe you could say you're not just a person. Well, you're really not even a person. By person, I mean you're not this personality, this body, mind that we all have. And when you just think about this, when you refer to your body, you don't refer to it as, I am a body. You say, my body. I have a body, or I'm in, you know, my body. And the implies that the body is something you have. It's not something that you are. We don't think about these things, but if you even look at the languaging of it, you know, my mind, so you're not the mind, my body, my feet, my hands, all of this. So that is what I mean by a person, and also this body-mind sort of organism. That, and most of us think that we're this body-mind, this body with this mind together. We think that's who we are. And this, and what I'm going to kind of explore today is you are not that. You are not that. You are not a person in the sense of this body, mind, sort of organism that has been sort of developed over time. And even if you think about it, I know for me when I think about this, when you were little, I often feel like I'm the same sort of. I'm the same when I was little as I am now, and I'm 51 years old now in terms of this chronological body age. But when I think of, you know, myself or my beingness, it feels like I'm still a girl in some ways. Yes, I mean I've learned some things intellectually, but you know, when I in terms of sort of awareness and viewing life and all of that, I feel the same. So just look at that. We refer to our body as mind. So that means that it can't be us if it's something that we have. It's something that we can witness. It's something we're aware of. And if we're aware of it, then there has to be some sense that it's not us. Okay. We most of us feel the same on a basic level. We feel we were the same in terms of witnessing life through as when we were kids. So it's just like the body is changing, the body is growing, but that who we are is the same. It's like if you have children, you know, you could see this more when you have children. And you see them, they come in, they're the baby, and then they grow and they develop physically, but that soul, that spirit of them is the same, okay? So what accounts for that? That there's this physical thing that's growing, but, you know, the core of this being, you know, this precious child, this being, is this, what you love about them, inherently what you love about them is the same, the spirit is the same, okay? That which you love the spirit. And no matter what form or shape the form takes, it's that spirit. And that's really who that particular being is. They're not the body, and they're not all the things they think. They're something else, and it's more of an elusive thing because it's not. And here I think is, you know, why it can be so easy to believe that we're this body is because this elusive, not elusive, but this awareness, this soul, whatever it is, it's indescribable, really. We don't really know what it is because it's not something that can be known because it is the sort of source and the subject of everything. You can't really know a subject, okay? All right. So the process goes, so speaking of kids, so and babies. Ooh, babies are so wonderful. I just love them. Because they're still sort of in that space of who we really are, although it's unnameable, there's something you can feel about it because in the absence of So your baby, and babies, I mean, there are studies that have shown this, they haven't really developed a sense of a separate self yet. Okay. So they're just here, and they're just, life's just unfolding. They don't have opinions about it. The mental process has not started yet. It's just not kicked in yet, okay? And there's really no distinguishing characteristics yet between them and their mothers and their caretakers. And it's just sort of like this experience of happenings, okay? And then over time, the mental process begins to develop, okay? And this mental process, aided by the conditioning of that baby, you know, the conditioning of being told, you know, you're a certain name, you know, you're Ann or you're Jim or you're John and you're this, and I am mommy and I am daddy and this is a car and this is a toy and this is your little brother. And so the mental process starts going in, and internally where, you know, there can begin to be questions after about the age of two or so, you know, I think it kicks in. And a lot of this stuff is done unconsciously. A lot of the programming conditioning is done unconsciously in terms of the end being doesn't know that they're being conditioned. But there begins to be a question at some point about who am I? And through all this conditioning, it begins to think it's a body, partly because there are sensations that are happening in the body. You know, there's in terms of, you know, touch and hunger pains and bodily functions. And there begins to sort of be this sort of a tattooing or takeover, and this mistaken identity, an identity begins to form that I am this body, okay? And that's aided, like I said, with the conditions of being told who you are and with the conditions of everything that's going on around them, and then the sense of separation and distinction begins to take place. And if these distinctions that are around them then are somehow causing physical harm to the child, then the senses of identities and senses of self get formed, and then the mental process kicks in, and the being begins to ask questions of itself, and then it itself begins to conclude, oh, I am this body, I am this quote person, I am this with a name, and I am the separate individual, and it begins to be sort of like glued or molded to this sense of being a body, and sense of then being this separate, long-lasting person, okay? And so over time, this develops, and as the mental process develops, okay? Now, before that, there was no sense of some separate, you know, identity, that individual who, you know, can live or die. There was just a beingness, okay? So in this, and you could say, okay, well, why are you talking about this? Well, this is part of the human, this is how we as human beings develop and become, you know, sort of healthy human beings or healthy person. Because they're, in order to be in this human experience, so what I'm saying, there's nothing wrong with any of this. It's not bad. In fact, it's intentional. And so we as beings are intentionally coming here into this experience and intentionally putting ourselves into the trance of being a separate, you know, the idea of being a separate, long-lasting individual entity, individual purpose. We're doing it on purpose to have this experience of what it's like to have to be a separate individual entity, or seemingly, we can never be separate, but seemingly through these bodies, okay? It's sort of like I've mentioned before in these classes, it's like having the body being like an action figure, or like having an avatar. You know, I think most people have seen that movie, The Avatar. And it's like the being, which doesn't know separation, which is at one with everything, in order to have the experience of separation, it created a way to sort of put itself into a trance so it could temporarily have the experience of what it feels like to know what what separation is. And really, now here's the real kicker. It's really not to know what separation is. It's really to have more of an experience of what one what oneness is, because you can't really know what oneness is. So it has to create a sense of separation, and it's through knowing you. But you can know objects. So in separation, things become objects. There is the subject. If you separate out the oneness into tiny parts, then that oneness can have the experience of these tiny parts. And the tiny parts are like objects, and you can say, in a sense, our individual person, body, minds are like objects, and you get to experience. So you get the experience of all of this, you know, subject-object relationships, and you get the experience of separation. So you can know that. Okay, you can know that, but you can't really know the oneness, because the oneness is really what's knowing everything. You can't really know the one. But what you can do is, but the oneness can know what it's not, okay? And it's through creating all of this separation, all of these different objects, and in knowing that, then it's like, okay, I know what that is. But then when you realize, oh, but I'm not that, in that moment of, well, but I'm not this body, there is a presence that takes place, because when we're molded, when we're tattooed, when we're in a trance of thinking we're a body, it's like everything gets experienced through the filter of this body-mind that we are. But if you begin to question and go, well, wait a minute, once you have the experience of this body-mind and you live life and you have these experiences as a separate, as a seeing separate, independent entity, and you get tired of that, because eventually we get tired of that, because as soon as we begin to believe that we're a separate, long-lasting individual, anxiety sets in. Mental anxiety sets in, because, first of all, it's not who we are, and there's always that part of us that's going to try to remind us that's not who we are. But in the belief that you're a separate individual, there's anxiety, because then there's the fear that I could die, I could be destroyed, I could be annihilated. You know, if I'm this separate individual entity, there's something bigger than me, and if I'm separate, then something can happen to me. Something could be done to me. And in this separate world of bodies, you know, we can do things to bodies. We can hurt bodies and minds, but we can't really hurt the being that we are, but we can hurt bodies. I mean, at least in this particular realm that we have created, bodies can be hurt, and bodies do sort of, quote, you know, move on or die or pass on or become, you know, into the earth. So as soon as there is this, you know, belief, this trance-like, that we are this separate individual, there is this fear that gets set in automatically. And it's like this underlying anxiety, okay? And a lot of times it's really buried over by, you know, a lot of mental noise, and we think it's something else, and we think it's because we don't have enough money, or we think we don't have a relationship. We think it's all these other things, but really the root of all of this discontent is that at this very beginning of this belief that we are this person who is a separate, you know, entity, separate long-lasting entity, because at that point, you know, there's always been this fear that something could happen to this separate, you know, long-lasting entity. If it's, of course, if it's a body, because something will happen to it. Okay, so, you know, but you know, as I said, this is like that movie. It's a playground. I mean, there are many things to kind of experience. There are many objects to kind of to play with, and you know, it has its place. To the oneness, it's a fun game. It's, you know, like I said, it doesn't have it, and it creates this sense of all of this going on, and it gets to play like going to an amusement park or to a playground. But at some point, you know, that part gets tired of the game and wants to experience this oneness again. And but it's through this experience of separation, it's through all of this that then because we've that part has had the experience of separation, in the when it's seemingly gone, or when you seemingly drop it, there's the presence can come in then. So instead of it being, you know, separate individual objects, it's just like if it's gone, then you can, through the absence of all of the separateness, there's the presence of the oneness. And so it's like through we get to experience sort of oneness. We can't ever know it, but it's like the best we can know it is through the absence of the separation. So it's almost like we create separation to be able to have an experience of the oneness. It's like going from unconscious oneness, and unconscious oneness, there's just oneness, you can't know oneness, and creates separation. So unconscious oneness creates separation, and is conscious of the separation, unconscious oneness to conscious separation, back to conscious oneness. So the conscious separation is created to be able to have the experience of the oneness. Through the conscious separation, and then when you can drop the separation, that presence of oneness, which is always there, but it just gets, you just get into a trance into the separation, so you don't experience the oneness. But once you wake up from the trance and you drop the sense of separation, then that you get to like feel that oneness. And so it's really an interesting thing. Now, this might be hard to grok, but just kind of don't try to grok it so much with your mind. Just sort of feel the energy of what I'm saying. So this is the game, going from unconscious oneness to conscious separation back to conscious oneness. Now, one example of this that might help you understand what I'm saying about this particular point is that, okay, so here we live on the planet, and there's gravity. Well, I saw this program last night about the universe, how the universe works, and all the planets have these gravitational pulls. Anyway, so Earth, you know, we're on, and gravity. So gravity is here, and we've never not known gravity. It's like it's always been here. It's like we don't know anything else. We don't have any experience of it not being gravity. But we don't even think about it. We don't even talk about it. It's not something we talk about. But if you were to suddenly go to outer space or somewhere or go to an anti-gravity chamber, then you would feel the gravity is gone. So equate the gravity to separation. When you sort of become bonded to this idea that you're a body, you're a person, you know, and it happens so young that you just live, you know, and we put ourselves into this trance so early, so young, we just believe it's who we are. So just equate gravity with this sense of being a person or a body. And you just don't even know you're anything else. I mean, some people have experiences when they're early that tells them otherwise. But for the most part, most of us just are completely entranced, okay? So you go somewhere then where there's not gravity. And in that experience, you get to feel, oh. Then you get to feel what the sort of space of the presence is like without the gravity, okay? And so it's like this is sort of the game we're playing. It's like, wow, and you get to experience what was there all along, but the gravity had this weight on you that you couldn't experience the space, but the space is there, but the gravity's been there, and sort of keeping you, been living in this place of gravity, thinking that thinking that it is the only reality, and then you go somewhere and the gravity's gone, and you get to then experience, oh, the space. Well, it's the same thing here, this sense of being a separate self. And then if you begin to question, just begin to question, wait a minute, well, am I this body? No, am I aware of this body? Yeah, I'm aware. That means I can't be it. These thoughts. And then the other thing is we think we're thinking thoughts. We think we're doing something with the body. And if you think about it, half your breathing is not controllable. I mean, you can control parts of your breath, but most of the time it's just controlling on it. I mean, there's something that's actually doing the breath. What is that? There's something that's actually, you know, moving all of the functions. When you have a bodily function where you have to go to the bathroom, are you doing it? No, you're not doing it. You know, there's something that's doing it. And if we, you know, were to have to take care of all the body functions, we probably wouldn't last very long. you know, because it'd be too much to try to maintain. But there's something, and that something, so I'm surmising that we're so much more than we even think about, but we don't even think to question, or like I said, because we're so entranced. But if you begin to start to ask simple questions, one, okay, well, what's keeping this body going? I'm not this body, but what's keeping it going? That's the animating force. It's what we really are, this presence, this beingness, this intelligence that has nothing to do with the mind. And if you notice this, you know, it's just something that's bigger than the body mind, that's other than the body mind. That's one thing. And then, you know, when we sleep at night, so, you know, we go to sleep, just begin to ask yourself or look at dream state. When we're dreaming, we're often other characters in dreams, or what we are really is we're witnessing. We're witnessing whole plays in dreams, whole scenes in dreams. And sometimes we're part of the dreams, and sometimes, at least I can speak for my own dreams, sometimes I'm in the dreams and I'm a character in the dream and I'm myself in the dream. But what I'm always in the dream is I'm always the one that's witnessing the dream that can then be here to tell about it after I've woken up. And, you know, so what is that that's witnessing the dream? That is the me. But what me? It's not the body, because the seeming body is on the bed asleep. My eyes are closed. How come I can see and move and do all kinds of things in this dream as if I'm in a different world? So what is that that's able to create all of this in consciousness, or wherever it's taking place? You know, if you don't think it's taking place in consciousness, just think, wherever it's taking place, who's witnessing it? Okay, and what is that? What is it that is witnessing it? Okay, that same, it's the same what, the same sort of presence that's witnessing the body as it, quote, ages, as it goes from a baby to an older citizen or older, you know, body, okay? But there's something that is the same through all of this. There's something that's witnessing it, the dream state, that's witnessing this seeming reality state. So begin to ask these questions and just to, you know, experiment and explore. And is it possible that we are not this body mind? And in terms of our thoughts, same thing. Okay? They have, I don't know, I mean, I've heard different things about how many thoughts we have a day, but it's thousands of thoughts that, you know, go through our minds a day. And we are not thinking all these thousands of thoughts, these the thoughts that are moving through, but we attach to certain thoughts, again, based on a sense of who we think we are, a sense of identity, a sense of ourselves. I mean, there's some thoughts that go through my, if you really think about thoughts that go through your mind that you don't pay any attention to, you know. And there are thoughts that you pay attention to, and then you grab onto those thoughts and you say, those are my thoughts. Again, the body mind is receiving thoughts, and you know, there's a mental process, this sense of self, that this sense of self, who early on asked who it was and then decided it was this body and it was this body-mind apparatus, and everyone has a different body-mind kind of combination, okay? But really there is one big mind, but everybody has a different body-mind combination. That's theirs uniquely. But there are thoughts that are going around, thoughts that, and then this particular body-mind combination, dependent on conditioning and just its own unique perspective, can take the thoughts, and it's like it hijacks the thoughts, and it says, oh, that's my thought. And as soon as it says that's my thought, based on this sense of self, then there begins to be this stuckness, this attachment to the thoughts. And I'm playing around lately with just watching thoughts and, you know, being aware of thoughts, seeing thoughts. And what if I didn't, claim that thought is mine? It's just an idea. What if I just didn't claim that that's my thought? And I just go, that's interesting. Because, I mean, haven't you had thoughts where, I wonder what would happen if I jumped off this platform onto that train? Now, this may seem very morbid, but, you know, there you have, I mean, and I thought, and I could, if I attach to that thought and go, oh, my God, why am I thinking that thought? Do I want to commit suicide? And what's wrong with me? And how, why should I have that thought? But, you know, it's just a thought that came, you know, and I let it go. It's like, oh, interesting. Okay, but it's a difference between claiming it as my thought and just seeing their thoughts all around. I remember I was in a bar, a club. I don't really go to bars that much, but I went to listen to music, and it was over the holidays, and I think it was, Friday night, and I went to listen to the band. And after the band does like three or four sets, and as each set goes, the band gets a little bit more, the music gets a little bit younger because they start off with playing some 70s, 80s, which I love that 70s, 80s, old school music. And then it started, and it begins to cater to the crowd as it gets later and later in the evening. And I usually leave after the second or the third set, but I was with some people and I stayed, and the bar got really crowded, and the music got wilder and wilder and louder and louder. And I just remember hearing so many different thoughts. And it was like it was so many people, you know, packed. And I just kept hearing a lot of, like, sexy thoughts. And at first I thought, wow, why am I thinking about these things all of a sudden? And then I realized I was just picking up on thoughts that were going around, and I could attach to them or not. But it was very, very funny. So just begin to pay attention and notice and think about these thoughts. You can't even really, or you can, but just even begin to contemplate whether or not, you know, certain thoughts are even yours. I mean, you can make them yours, but that wouldn't even really be accurate. You know, it's just something you're attaching to. So, but we are so used to thinking we're the thinker, first of all, that we're the separate, independent, long-lasting, you know, person, okay? And that is actually itself. I think the biggest thing I want to say is that actually is a mental process. But that is not even really the case, truly the case. This sense of self that you believe you are, it's just a sense of a self. It's a mental sense that sort of combined with sort of this physical sensation sense, and it makes it seem really, really real. But even that is not really who you are. And even when you dream at night, you're dreaming and you're witnessing the dream. I don't know. I know for me, I'm not even this sense of self that I've created. Sometimes I am, but I'm not even that sense of self that I have sort of used to believe that I was even drops in some of my dreams. In some of my dreams, I'm in a different age or, you know, and sometimes even I've been on a different planet or just a different environment altogether. But this sense of self that is Clarissa Bell that has been, you know, developed over these years even has dropped. And that to me says that it's not really real because it's not the eternal presence that sort of is this unchanging sort of backdrop in which everything or this eternal ground upon which everything is happening and this screen of reality or the screen of awareness in which this seeming reality or this apparent reality is happening. If that sense of self can shift and change, then it's really not eternally real. It itself is a mental process. And I think it was the hardest part of all of this, and it's the scariest part, because when I first entertained this idea that this sense of myself is not even real, that it itself is just a thought, it itself is just a mental process, it itself has been developed through mental processing, that it's not like eternal real. A part of me was like deathly afraid because I thought I was going to die, because if I think that I am it, and I hear that somehow it's not real, then there's this fear, well, if I'm not it and it's not real, then what's going to happen to me? And the thing, and this is why this is so tricky, because it's looking at it from the perspective of the sense of the self. And so it's almost as if this whole sense of self has to, you know, sort of. So this is what you're. So it's like this whole this sense of self has to begin to feel that there's something more to it that doesn't die, and it can happen because. And so when you hear this long enough, and you hear it repeatedly, and you begin to ask these questions, and you begin to feel a presence that comes in, and even for a moment, it's like, oh, there's something else that in that moment gets to be experienced and felt. Then pretty soon what will happen is that presence, which is who we really are, we begin to understand. It's like that oneness is there anyway. It's like the oneness creates the separation. So even though it, you know, there's we get so entranced that we don't, quote, necessarily feel it consciously a lot, it is there because it created it. And because it is there, because it is a part of the two-ness, because it is a part of separation, it can always sort of, the two-ness can always sort of reflect back to the oneness, or the oneness can always reflect to the two-ness what it really is, what its presence. When the two-ness can sort of drop its stance on life and be open to then feeling the oneness that is inherent in the two-ness. Okay, I hope that made some sense. Okay, so and so something will hit that. Something will hit that sense of self at some point, where it will begin to feel something will, some thought, something it read in a book, some person or something will penetrate it enough. You know, maybe one time, maybe it'll only take one time, maybe it'll take a number of times. Who knows? But something will penetrate that sense of self. Well, it will stop, and it will have an experience of its sort of true nature, its true oneness. And in that, there's a willingness then to sort of drop it in that moment, and that presence then is almost like a, again, like gravity, you know, lifting, and then you feel what's there, been there all along. And then over a period of time, as you really begin to question, am I this self, and you drop it here and drop it there, and you continue to have that experience of the oneness, you will begin to relate more and more to this oneness as who you really are. And life goes on. Life continues. You know, we need the sense of self in terms to operate here in this realm, to operate in this realm, to get the body from place to place. But what happens is you begin to live a lot lighter, and instead of thoughts being my thoughts, they're thoughts, and instead of it being about my life needing to happen a certain way, because part of this whole sense of self is when we become sort of bonded to this sense of self, what happens is then we become as if we're God. It's like, so we're this sense of self, and we're the subject now. So instead of the oneness being the subject, it's like we are the subject and everything else is an object to us. And that includes God. Even God then becomes an object that we have to gain, an object that we have to get close to or connect to, an object that is you know, either going to be good to us or bad. It's everything is an object. We're the subject, and everything is an object that we either have to get to love us, or, you know, who, or either they've done something to us. And so we're in this subject-object relationship where we're the subject and everything is the object, including God, okay? But when we begin to question if we really are this separate entity, long-lasting entity, when we drop that, the idea of it, even just for a moment, and we get to experience the presence, we get to experience that as the subject. We get to experience that, and then this, it's like this experience of oneness just for a while. It's hard to really talk about this because it's hard to really. It can't be something that can be gotten with the mind. It has to be sort of your own personal experience. But I'm just trying to point the way to maybe begin to have this sort of this sort of not even experience, but this sort of experience of life. Words don't do here, but just see if you can feel the energy. So then in that moment, there is this experience of oneness. It's like with love. When you love something, you don't experience a separation with it. You experience this oneness. It's like love is oneness. There's no sense of separation. It's like that, okay? It's like when you begin to drop the idea that you're a separate entity, then the love that is life, that is God, that is who we are, that is the presence, is there. And in some ways, the subject-object sort of relationship sort of melts away. But we're not playing God, and we're not then afraid of what happens or doesn't happen. We can allow life to just unfold, trusting, just not even trusting, there's just this kind of knowing that life is good, life is love, because, you know, it's and there's just this more of an experience of living lightly, because it's not all taken so personally from this separate sense of self. It's life unfolding. And there is, like, we begin to live life, we begin to understand and about life from a different perspective. There's clarity. So life doesn't change. It's just that we have clarity about life. That's what's different. We're living life from a different perspective, a wider, broader understanding, and it brings clarity to our lives. It brings clarity to our life. And through that clarity and that changed perspective, we begin to experience things differently. And that's what actually changes our lives. And not from this personal sense of self, because it's almost like we're realizing, oh yeah, that's I'm not that self. I'm not that person. Who I am is this no thing that can't really be described. But through this sense of self, this having this action figure in this body and getting all these experiences, and when I let go of those, and in the letting go, I get to experience my oneness again. Again, this is all metaphor. It's not really the way it is, but it's metaphoric. So separation, the body, it's all for this grand, glorious purpose. One, to have fun, and two, to, you know, when we're ready to begin to experience oneness consciously, okay? So we get to experience oneness consciously. And just the common thing that I'd like to talk about that happens along this path is I did this, you know, religiously. It's a common thing is, okay, so we're the sense of self, we think we're a person, and so this sense of self, like I said, at the core, there's always this sense of anxiety, because we deep down, there's a knowing that's not who we are. And again, when you think you're separate, of course, you're going to think God's separate from you, okay, and you're always wanting to be in favor and God's favor. There's always this fear, this underlying fear. And at some point, as happens in life, we're always really moving towards happiness. We all want to be happy, okay? And because now we're the subject and everything is the object, we all want to be happy, and we all think that what's going to make us happy are these objects outside of us that are going to be, and you know, that are going to do something wonderful for us, whether it's money or sex, or love, or relationships, or children, then these objects, these things, these special ones that we have, pinpointed, need to be a certain way, do certain things for us so that we can be happy, okay? Or if they don't, then they're the cause of our suffering and all this kind of stuff. So, and usually the form it takes is, okay, well, I'm going to better myself. I want to be a better person. I want to be a better person in the eyes of, quote, God. I want to be a better person so I can, you know, attract that special someone. I want to be a better person so someone will like me. I want to be a better parent. I want to be a better daughter. I want to be a better son. I want to be a better employee. And, I mean, we're on this constant, you know, treadmill of self-improvement. So when you think you're this person, we're always, or the self, you know, we're the separate self. You know, the bookstore has a big aisle of self-improvement. You just go down self-improvement. You see all these books on self-improvement. We're busily improving ourselves. I mean, that's what we are constantly doing. So when you have a self, of course, and now you're constantly improving that self. But since and there's nothing wrong with any of it. Some of it's fun. Lord knows I did a lot of it. But the actual core issue is not in improving the self. You can improve the self. Yeah, it's better to improve the self in terms of you probably be a little bit happier with an improved self than a not improved self. But, I mean, how long does it really last? There's still suffering, you know. And so my point is that at some point you'll get to the place where you'll hear something like this or you'll hear it because the actual issue is this believing that we are the self as a self. It's not believing that we are this separate self. That's really the issue. That's really where the anxiety is. And so whether it's an improved self or, you know, a debilitated self or dysfunctional self, I mean, there's still going to be the sense of anxiety. So it's really coming to this place where really coming to, well, what is our true identity? What am I really? You know, am I this separate sense of self? And if we believe we are, then we suffer. And it could be exquisite suffering. I mean, you know, I mean, it's all part of the dance. It's all part of the fun. Nothing wrong with it. Nothing wrong at all with any of all of this. But for real freedom, it's really beginning to question and whether or not we're this sense of ourselves. So I could say more and more about this, and I will talk more about this, but I just wanted to give a general picture of you are not a person, and I hope that you were able to glean some sort of, it's whatever. And my job is just to say it. Whatever anyone takes from it is their job or is their life, okay? So there, it's out there, and I give it with great joy in my heart. And now I'm just going to go over today. Today is April 12th. I didn't see there were very many people on the line, so I just kept right on talking. But today is April 12th, 2011, and we're in Aries territory. And today, if you were born today, you have a Nine of Diamonds birth card and a King of Clubs ruling card. And a Nine of Diamonds is it's only one of two cards that has all diamonds as a birth card and as karma cards. So the Nine of Diamonds has the Queen of Diamonds and the Five of Diamonds as its karma cards. So it's got three diamonds, and the other card that has that is the Queen of Diamonds. The Queen of Diamonds has the Three of Diamonds and the Nine of Diamonds as karma cards. So, but when someone has so many diamonds, that means their lives are all about value, you know, because diamonds represent value, what we value, and money. Because money is a big thing we value. So this means their life's all about value, and everything has a price or value. But for them, what it boils down to is their self-value, their self-worth. They are seeking perfect self-worth. And nines is a universal number, which means that they're here to give. They're here to let go, number one, because after the rightness of the eight, then you have the nine, which then the cycle begins to end. And so nines are here to let go. They're here to complete some kind of major chapter of evolution on a soul level. Okay, and this means for nines, you know, giving on a universal level. It means giving to others and being willing to release people and material things from their life. So nines sometimes can feel like they lose things and that there's a lot of loss, but that's really, you know, part of what they've come here. They've come to let go, okay? And so they have to heed the call to give and to let go of others. You know, they may be called to let go of money and relationships and love. And we all are to some extent, you know. And the thing is with the nines, though, but if they realize this and they let go willingly, then and they embrace that and they find a way to give to humanity universally, then they'll be able to walk this path. Otherwise, their lives will be filled with disappointment and remorse, okay? And so on the positive side of that, they do this. They can be philanthropic, generous, and happy. And in fact, you know, you get a lot of politicians that are nine. President Obama's a Nine of Diamonds. Actually, so was George W. Bush's a Nine of Diamonds. That congresswoman who got shot, Gabrielle Giffords, she's a Nine of Diamonds. Hillary Clinton is a Nine of Hearts. So you get a lot of politicians because nines are about giving universally, and politicians at its core, you know, at its positive root, and why a lot of politicians initially get into politics is because they have a desire to help, you know, humanity or to help large groups of people. I mean, the system may be a little bit wacky, but I think at heart, you know, politicians, they start out wanting to be of service to others, okay? And the Nine of Diamonds is, can be good in business because they really have the inborn capacity to sell things and to promote things they really believe in. It's because they have a Jack of Diamonds and Jupiter, and the Jack of Diamonds is the salesperson's card, and Jupiter is where we can make money. And they have great minds because they have Two of Clubs in Venus and a King of Clubs in Mars, and I'm going to talk about their King of Clubs because King of Clubs is their ruling card. But Clubs is the mind, and Two of Clubs, and Two is logic, and King is the highest suit of the mind. So with this, you know, they have great minds, and they're attracted to work that allows them to use their intellectual abilities. This means they're great talkers, great communicators, and a lot of them can become counselors because, again, counseling is something of giving to people, okay? And if they don't become counselors professionally, they can, you know, they'll become counselors to their friends. They like having people to talk to, and they prefer relationships with those, that, you know, who are witty and smart because they're so intelligent. So, yeah, and the last thing about the Nine of Diamonds that I like to share is they have a marriage card in their Saturn position. And the Saturn position is sort of the limiting, restricting position. And having a Four of Hearts there, which is the marriage and family card, it means that you know, they'll have at least one challenging marriage of a karmic nature of some kind, because Saturn's kind of karmic. Or they'll usually have some kind of unusual responsibilities associated with family, children, brothers and sisters, anything to do with family, okay? But marriage is usually destined for them, and it's often long-lasting. And they tend to have traditional values about marriage, okay, and can be very easy to get along with. So that's a bit about the Nine of Diamonds. And added to that with the King of Clubs ruling card, King of Clubs is a very, very powerful card. What every king is, the King of Clubs is like, it's like the king of the clubs, king of the mind. This is a card of knowledge and master of distinctions. They're really able to make, you know, distinctions. Now, it's also, they're the Uranus card in the deck, and so they're, you know, in the row and in the column. So that means they have a lot of Uranian energy. This means their life is devoted to freedom and pursuit of truth. They live by their own truth. Rarely do they live their life to any doctrine or philosophy other than their own. So these are very powerful people. And because it sits at the top of the suit of the clubs, they have everything they need to be an authority, okay? And their mind, like I said, they have great minds, and their mind is inexhaustible. And one of their greatest assets is their ability, like I said, to make fine distinctions, okay? And this makes them witty and personable, and it usually makes them popular and well-liked. And they're also one of the most psychic cards in the deck, okay? And so much so that their intuitive approach to life is second nature. They don't even realize they're intuitive. I mean, it's just sort of a part of their makeup, okay? And they have a good life path, a fortunate life path, because all the cards in their life path are even numbered. Now, the one thing about this, though, is that they have the Six of Clubs and the Six of Spades and Uranus and Neptune in their life path. And sixes can bring about a sense of stagnation sometimes, so that can set in from time to time. And for a King of Clubs, that would mean they do a lot of mental fathering in their minds, thinking about things, and thinking and thinking and thinking rather than taking action and moving forward. Sometimes they can just be found waiting for the next phase and to unfold before them, and this can actually make them feel a bit powerless, okay? And the other challenge is that the King of Clubs is a very masculine card, but they have a Queen of Hearts and Pluto, and whatever is in our Pluto position in our life path is called the challenge card. It's something that we have to transform in our life. So you get the King of Clubs, which is very masculine, very mental-oriented, and the Queen of Hearts, which is the most feminine card in the deck, the Queen of Hearts, it's the mother. It's the sensual, nurturing, just think of the warm mother type, you know. And so here they have it in their challenge position. So it's like, you know, the Queen of Hearts is going to drop the heart knows facts, which is what the King of Clubs wants to look at, and it's going to drop it in favor of love and pleasure and following her feelings. So this is sort of like a dichotomy and a challenge for the King of Clubs. And for the female King of Clubs, what this will present is they may have trouble fitting into feminine roles, okay? And then for the males, most of them will have sort of a mother complex, and usually they will get into relationships with other heart women, women who have heart cards. It's sort of to work this through. But once King of Clubs kind of work this through, then they actually do well in marriage, okay? They have good marriage karma. They seem to work best with the partner, and this is because they have a Two of Spades as a first karma card, and the Two of Spades is also their Jupiter card in their life path. So Jupiter is wherever we make money and work and that kind of thing. So this Two of Spades like to do things with people. It's partnership, but space means doing things. They like to work together, hike together, play together. You know, they want to be doing things together. So a Two of Spades is a prominent card in their life. So they do best. Their work is best in partnership. And they're suited for leadership ability, first of all, for being a king and responsibility and even fame. And this is because their cosmic reward, their cosmic lesson, and their cosmic moons all fall in the crown line. The crown line is those three positions at the very top of the spread. And so that's really kind of prominent to have, you know, those three cards that are actually sitting in the crown line. And history is full of famous King of Clubs, so... And so that would be the ruling card. So you'd have this Nine of Diamonds, which would be tinged by this King of Clubs. And some people born on today is David Cassidy, that famous singer who was famous very early. Claire Danes, also one who was famous as a teenager. She had that TV show. Vince Gill, the country singer. He's a wonderful man. And David Letterman, that would make sense. King of Clubs, you know, late night talk show. And Shannon Doherty. Okay, so those are just some examples. And I think we're at the top of the hour. And I thank you all for allowing me to have a voice. Well, I have a voice, but allowing me, well, for listening to me. So, everyone, that's the class for today, and more like a lecture for today, and I hope you enjoyed, and I will be here in 2 weeks on April 26th, and I will be here, okay? All right, good night, good afternoon, everyone. Bye.